Hey guys, welcome to the Sisyphus 55 podcast. Today we're joined by Olivia's son, Ollie's son Via. I'm sure you know of her channel. If you want to introduce yourself a little bit for people that don't know.
Yeah. So my name's Olivia. Ollie's son Via is my channel, like he said. I do like philosophy, video essays. I was on this podcast once, like last year before, and so I'm back again because Sisyphus wants views, and I never know what to say after that when people ask.
I mean, what's your, like, because you're not just doing YouTube, you also, you're in a university
okay.
also.
Right, yeah, okay, outside of YouTube, I'm in my last year of my undergrad studies. I'm a philosophy specialist. Trying to get into the master's program as well as law school this year, so fingers crossed that that works out. Yeah.
Cool. And I guess, like, on that note, what I wanted to talk about today was, I guess broadly how you got into philosophy, but specifically kind of existentialism and that route, because both of us have made videos on existentialism. And I guess I'm kind of curious, did you have some sort of, like, existential crisis or like some sort of personal kind of like kind of questioning values and like meaning and stuff like that? Because a lot of people, I mean, I went through that like in high school and like early 20s. So
Well, I'd love to hear your story after I tell mine. But it's pretty funny because I don't know why I was like this, but when I was like 6 years old, I already would constantly have nightmares about the world ending. Like, you can ask my mom. I would constantly have to, like, ask her to sleep with me because I'd just, like, wake up crying, like, no, the world's gonna end and I'm also gonna die.
Like, what ways were you imagining the world was gonna end? Like,
I don't know if... I can't really recall because I was 6 years old, but my six-year-old imagination was definitely thinking, like, massive natural disasters or, like, somehow the, like, the world just shattering. She actually bought me a book when I was like 8 years old called How to Stop Worrying. It was like a self-help book for like adults, but she got it for me. Yeah. So I think I've always had some sort of like dread about existence and death, even from when I was little. Mm-hmm. Definitely like preteen and teen years came up because I think a lot of people in their teen years start to feel really insecure and question like where their worth or value comes from. And I find often that leads to people being like, oh, so what's the point of me living? Or what if I just died? What's the purpose of any of this? So yeah, I think taking all of that really seriously in my like teen years got me really interested in existentialism when I discovered it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's interesting. So it was mostly kind of a anxiety-based kind of catastrophizing, like kind of, I guess, dealing with like uncertainty.
Yeah, that's a big part of it. And also just, I was insecure as a kid. And I mean, I talked a little bit about it in my video on the desire to be sad, but I really just had a low sense of like self-worth. Mm-hmm. And I think that leads people to question, you know, like the purpose of their existence.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, because I've always wondered kind of like about the link between like self-esteem and like interest in existentialism, because you're in some way you're trying to gain control over the fear of uncertainty by like really looking at other people who have thought about this in the past. But it's also like kind of wallowing in it, or you're kind of like further going into it, because it's not like a lot of people have a lot of like solutions for it. It's more like a, you know, like Kierkegaard, there's like the leap of faith is like one. And like, I guess we can get into it later, but yeah, Sartre, where you, like, you create your own meaning, Camus, where you kind of rebel against the meaninglessness of it. All of those seem like a lot to deal with, especially if you're also just having kind of basic self-esteem issues. Okay, that's interesting. Do you remember which thinkers you kind of gravitated towards specifically?
I mean, I think I really, really liked Sartre when I first learned about him, and then Simone de Beauvoir, like, you know, after, because I feel like people always find out about each those two, like, together. Of course, like, Camus, because who doesn't read The Myth of Sisyphus when they first get into, like, philosophy and existentialism in particular? I think just, like, Sartre's idea about, like, everyone having this like fundamentally free core and being able to actually do anything you want, that was really appealing to me at a time where I felt like I didn't have control over my life, and I kind of maybe felt like there was either this path I could take in life or this path. And it was freeing to hear someone say like, oh, no way, like you could really go beyond that.
Yeah, do you think it's like kind of that emphasis on authenticity that a lot of the existentialists share at the end of the day? Is like they're very like, it's a consistent theme of like they feel like a lot of people are really like lying to themselves about things, or they're being like coerced like socially to do things that isn't like their true essence, kind of.
Yeah, so I wouldn't say they would talk about essence, because they have that whole like existence precedes essence slogan, but I do think like if you think about the historical context about which like existentialism emerged from, I feel like there was a lot of questioning authority at that time because of like the rise of more secular communities, so stopping obeying like a divine authority, and then also World War One, World War Two, where people saw like maybe the problems of having one absolute leader. And so I think existentialism, yeah, definitely has sort of like, you disobey authority because just following norms or one person might lead you to an inauthentic self.
How would you kind of characterize authenticity?
That's really hard. And I've thought about it for a long time, because there's like, in the, to talk about there being an authentic self almost seems like you have to presume that there is a self that exists before you work on it. And I don't really know how true that is, especially because a lot of people's conception of what their self is might come from like socialization or like norms that might actually be harmful or untrue. But I mean, if you think about Sartre or like some other existentialist thinkers, they have the ideas about an authentic life being one in where you really like cultivate that radical freedom, and you try to act with your freedom and recognize that you are free at all times, and that you don't define yourself by like a set category. So you don't say like, oh, I am a lawyer, or oh, I am an Olympic swimmer, and I am always going to be a swimmer. And then if you like, I don't know, get into an accident and then you aren't able to use your legs anymore, you should be able to like refocus your life and say, no, being a swimmer didn't define me. I can do something else outside of that. So I think maybe the dynamic, the ability to like change might be...
Is authenticity?
Yeah, at least to some of these thinkers. But personally, like for my own belief, I'm not quite sure I have a good like grasp of it. I don't know. Do you have like an idea of it?
I mean, actually, I think I didn't think about it before, but like the idea of change or like adapting is kind of a good... I think that's a good thread in existentialism, is because it's like, I feel like the existential school is like one of the most courageous regarding like they're able to like be like, oh, there actually is no like meaning, or there is no like kind of larger systems we should look at, and people should be like, people should really follow like what they want to do, which could be like potentially like scary. It's like, how do you actually justify doing anything if there's like no like meaning in the universe? And like all of society's values are like not really like useful or like not really legitimate. But then it's like they take on the task of how do you then justify action or existence? And I think regarding change, it's almost like that, it's like that idea of like hope also. So like with Sartre, it's like, and Beauvoir, it's like authenticity or some sort of like human flourishing or like self-actualization through being yourself or like creating your own meaning. And then with Camus, and then that's like a form of change in a way. And then with Camus, it's like this weird like rebellion. Like it's this kind of like staunch like position against the meaningless of things by like in a paradoxical way, like embracing it. And then what I really like, and he's not like, he's not referenced that often, but Gabriel Marcel, who's like a Christian existentialist, he kind of like, it's like similar to Camus. He has this idea of like strange hope, where you like there's something inherent about human beings where they like hope for things, like regardless of like what that object of desire or hope is. We will just continually, like, for the most part, try to justify our own existence. And he almost, like, fully leans into that. And he says, like, that's kind of where, like, in a roundabout way, like, that's where, like, God is. Or that's where, like, that is the essence of existence, is this, like, weird, like, or just, like, that the human spirit to just, like, continually try to, like, justify being. And to do so does involve this process of, like, becoming or, like, some sort of change or something like that. I don't know if that really makes sense, but it's, like, kind of, yeah, I guess, like, the sort of, like, focusing on the process rather than some sort of destination or, like, salvation or something like that seems to be something to do with authenticity, but that's way too vague, and that seems like something that's, like, very, like, each person would have to find for themselves, because existentialists don't tend to, like, make stakes or, like, claims about, like, what that would look like necessarily.
Yeah, I don't remember who said this anymore, but just, like, about the activity of, like, becoming rather than just, like, being in a stable sense, I think there's a lot of focus just on telling yourself, like, okay, I am constantly in a state of becoming rather than just, like, to be. And I think that that was a helpful mantra, at least for me, when I was trying to get out of, like, feeling stuck in one place.
Yeah, I mean, also, I think, like, looking at Sartre's idea of bad faith might be useful in defining, like, what authenticity is, if you want to maybe introduce what that is a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, just generally, it's kind of similar to what we were talking about, living an inauthentic existence, but Sartre has this idea about either acting in good faith or bad faith. And so to act in bad faith would be, like the example I said before, just saying, oh, I am just a swimmer, and that is all I am, that's what defines me. To act in bad faith is to think that you are a static being that can be defined by some sort of essence, and to, like, reject the idea that you have the ability, the freedom to change that. And so I guess on the flip side, to act in good faith would be to recognize that freedom, to use it. Yeah, I don't know if you have anything else you want to add on that.
No, I think that's a good, I mean, yeah, he talks about it a lot, and, like, it's like a existentialism is humanism, I think, is, like, the main essay. And I guess going off of what you said, it's an emphasis on kind of not necessarily, like, that idea of, like, you can be whatever you want, but more so, like, you don't really know what you're capable of. Right. So don't completely limit yourself to just, like, one specific thing or one specific definition. It reminds me also of, like, in Taoism, like, the idea of genuine pretending, where you, like, attach to certain roles, like, in a very kind of, like serious, like, formal way, but with, like, the full acknowledgement internally that this role is, like, completely, like, it doesn't actually mean anything at the end of the day. So it's kind of, like, really emphasizing the importance of play. So I don't know how much that relates specifically to bad faith, but I always find that as, like, a constructive, like, addition to it, because it's kind of, like, it's, like, showing, like, it's still useful to, like, not just be completely nihilistic and, like, don't adapt any roles, but, like, if you're going to adapt these roles, like, fully, like, give it your 100%, but also it doesn't define who you are at the end of the day, because I think people could end up being, like, they get too attached to, like, specific roles or specific, like, identities, and, and I think, as you kind of mentioned at the start, like, the idea of, like, a very, like, rigid, essential identity, you know, a lot of people aren't comfortable with that, at least intellectually, even though that's kind of how we operate day to day.
Yeah. I mean, I've been taking a course on Michel Foucault and been going a lot into his work, and it's been really interesting. I'm finding, like, a lot of connections now with stuff that I've read from him. For example, you brought up the idea of how, like, just the idea of, like, play without any, like, end necessarily that you're trying to reach. And I think that's interesting to ask in terms of, like, why are we so obsessed with finding a purpose, like, an end goal for everything, not just, like, general existence, but everything. Like Foucault talks about how like it seems like the way a lot of our institutions or our spaces or are structured is that there's supposed to be some sort of like telos that we're supposed to be reaching, and he's kind of like, why don't we ever give ourselves time to just do things without some sort of goal? Like, do we ever allow ourselves to do like, I don't know, improv dance or like that's just an example off my head. I don't know if he was into like dancing.
I know he would party. I think that was one of
Or like taking, I don't know, psychedelics, like doing things where you don't really know how it will change you. And I think a lot of people, I understandably, are scared of doing things where they don't really know how it's going to turn out, but I do think that there is value from doing things without a set telos. I mean, maybe it would be helpful to try to like view life in a way where you're not chasing for some like intended purpose, but rather creating it day by day as you go on.
Yeah, I think like that's something that I like that was shared between like Camus, Nietzsche, and Marcel was they were all very against like that kind of commonly held religious belief that like there's going to be like all of this life is basically to like lead to the afterlife or lead to like some sort of like utopia or salvation. And like Nietzsche was very much like, no, like earth is both like heaven and hell. Like it is as much as you want to make of it. Basically we have no guarantee about like anything beyond that. And it is kind of going back to the discussion of hope, of just like hope in terms of like thinking there is some telos or outcome that you're like striving for. You know, it's there's no guarantee, and it can actually like take you away from like the present moment and from like things that really matter. I really like this like concept. I've been reading this book Cruel Optimism by Lauren Bartlett, I think, from 2011, and she's kind of applying this affect theory regarding like more like political social issues. And she's talking about cruel optimism, which is those objects of desire that we like pursue thinking that they're going to lead to some sort of happiness or like self-actualization, fulfillment, but they're also those very things that actually like hinder our like flourishing. So you can apply it to like basically like, I don't know, most things. Like I feel like in my head it comes up a lot in discussion. It's just people not realizing, you know, they get what they wish for and then they're unhappy in some way, or they're in an even worse position. And it's not really to say that you should just be like fully hedonistic, because I also think that in itself is you're kind of pursuing an object of desire that's like going to just, you know, it's not very sustainable too. But it's like you should just kind of really pay attention to those things that are like autotelic, or they give you like a sense of flow where it's like the engagement and experience of them already leads to like some fulfillment, and it like justifies the act in some way. Like improv dance, maybe.
Right. Yeah. That which Foucault obviously participated in.
Exactly.
I mean, again, as you were talking, I was thinking of something else that was brought up about how sometimes, you know, when people try to find meaning in their life, as you said, they can harp on to maybe some like categories or skills or activities, whatever it is that actually hinder their flourishing. And I heard about these two different theories as to why sometimes that happens. I don't know if you have maybe an opinion after you hear them on which one you think is like more plausible, but one of them comes from like some feminist literature where it's like, oh, why do, you know, because of like feminine socialization, a lot of women think that there are certain feminine activities that will give their life some sort of purpose or meaning. But even if women recognize that they're harmful, why do we still feel attached to it? For there's the example of being really good at makeup. And it's like, we know that makeup is created by a lot of like patriarchal institutions that want us to feel insecure, want us to spend our money so that you know, we can't walk outside ever feeling comfortable just being ourselves. But a lot of women also still find pride and can identify, like define themselves as being someone who is really good at makeup and maybe is even a makeup guru. And part of it is because things like this, you put in a lot of effort to acquire this skill. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes this skill that you're really proud of and that you worked hard on. And we're told that if you work hard on something, then mm-hmm. that surely must mean it is purposeful in some way. Mm-hmm. And so it's really hard to let go of it. So, kind of like
sunk cost fallacy is the...
I don't know if I would say it's just sunk cost. I mean, I can definitely see, like, that's part of it for sure. Mm-hmm. But I think also it's just, there's something more about, I feel like for sunk cost fallacy, sometimes it's like you actually don't even like what mm-hmm. you're doing, but you still do it because you spent effort.
Okay,
whereas for this, it's like, it's a skill that you feel proud of and you feel mm-hmm. like it does make you, I don't know, better or mm-hmm. like more skilled in some way, more admirable, but it's actually harmful in other ways.
Mm-hmm.
There was another theory about it from Judith Butler, who says that, well, we need to, like, why do we say, define ourselves in categories like, oh, I'm a finance bro and my purpose is to, like, calculate stocks, or like, I'm a gym bro and my purpose is to get super jacked. Mm-hmm. And it's because these categories or these norms are recognizable by other people in society, and what we really want is other people to recognize our existence. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, like, if I tell you, oh, I have ADHD, then you know how to treat it, you know the, like, accommodations you should apply to me, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But if I come to you being like, hey, I have this weird disease that, like, no one knows what to call it and no one really knows what it is, then no one knows how to act towards you, no mm-hmm. one knows what to say to you, and you kind of have to, like, suffer alone. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I also think that is one reason why perhaps I've over the years gone a little bit less fond of existentialism, just because I think it doesn't do a good enough job of recognizing, like, how systems and societal structures work to make us feel like we need to find some sort of meaning, and how we go about mm-hmm. finding meaning. Yeah, anyways, I've talked for a long time. I'll let you say
that's
something.
That's really interesting. Well, I do think, like, I mean, Judith Butler's interesting to bring up because they've been considered, like, gender abolitionists,
yeah.
for example. But they also recognize, going back to the makeup example, that there was a quote that they had was kind of saying, like, I'm not gender abolitionist, like, there's a kind of variety in how much people experience how close gender identity is to their sense of identity,
mm-hmm.
regardless of whether it's socially conditioned or biological or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And that's, like, fine, because there's a lot of seemingly harmless, like, practices. Like, somebody wearing makeup for the most part isn't, even if the origins might be sexist, it
yeah.
usually isn't going to lead to, like, it's not the same thing as, like, the, you know, wage gap, or, like, you know, you could probably make arguments where there's some associations, but if, like, a girl feels fine with, like, wearing makeup, then that's, like,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's overall, it's not, it's, if it's leading to more, like, happiness than, like, unhappiness, then, you know, I can see that argument. And I think in when Judith Butler was making that argument, it's, like, kind of an interesting, like, point almost, with regards to bad faith, is, like, what are the requirements for something to be bad faith? Like, if you could, mm-hmm. if you could tie it to the fact that it's socially conditioned, is that enough to refute it as, like, as an aspect of identity that's, like, inauthentic?
Right.
Because I also don't think, like, just being like, oh, things that are natural is really, like, a good argument. And maybe it is, like, the argument is, to what extent is this helping somebody flourish? Mm-hmm. Which is, like, such a subjective, like, I feel like yeah. that's just the subjective experience of the individual. And then I almost think, now I'm, like, really rambly, but I think that it kind of goes back to, like, arguments for and against choice feminism, where it's, like, if a woman is, like, for example, yeah, if a woman feels, like, regardless of criticisms about patriarchal norms, if they feel like they're comfortable in a traditional role, and then they're arguing that this is helping me flourish, like, is that bad faith, or is that
right.
Like, authentic living?
Yeah, I mean, Simone de Beauvoir definitely had strong opinions about that specifically. Like, I know she thought that even if you felt more comfortable in a traditional, like, household, I am the housewife situation, she'd say, like, that's not actually what you would really want. And she gives a pretty interesting analysis about how, like, being freed from a woman's biological state leads to women having the ability to be more free. But yeah, if I was thinking personally, though, I'd say that I definitely think that when it comes to women who sometimes maybe they make choices that you could say are in line with, like, patriarchy, I do think I would try to give women the benefit of the doubt first, that they have done a lot of complex moral reasoning on their own part, and they realize that perhaps no matter what they do, it's kind of going to lead to moral failure, and so this is just the choice they've gone with. And I think like in a world where a lot of people are just bound in this way, where there's really, like, it's like a lose-lose situation, it's hard to talk about something being like a purely good faith decision or a purely bad faith decision to me. I don't know if there's, like, something in Sartre or, like, other thinkers' work that explores this degree of good and bad faith, but yeah.
Yeah, no, I don't know. It's also a similar argument that I see come up with, like black conservatives, for example, where I think, like, people on the left, they will say, like, oh, like, you're just, like, being misinformed or, like, used or something like that. And there is, like, it definitely isn't, like, a rigid binary. It's, like, and you do have to kind of respect the autonomy and agency of people at the end of the day, and you have to kind of give them the benefit of the doubt, at least in my opinion. But yeah, I guess there are probably sometimes egregious examples where people might be, like, they might have just been misled, or there might be other,
Is Candace Owens acting in good or bad faith?
That's a great debate topic. Yeah, she seems like she's very, very good faith person, for sure. Yeah,
totally.
Oh, that's interesting. I guess, like, kind of going, because now we're talking about social values, like, you are also interested in, I mean, you're going to go to law school. Did existentialism have some sort of impact with regards to, like, you choosing to study law?
I'm gonna be totally honest, I don't think so. At least in terms of, like, my academic, like, interest in existentialism compared to, like, my academic interest in law and those two paths. But if I was thinking, maybe if I thought about it in a personal choice, like, did me getting into existentialism affect what I wanted to do in the future, then yeah, maybe, sure. Like, once I kind of figured out that I am free to do things in my life and I can create meaning, and then I think after that, because another limit, I think, of existentialism, at least the traditional versions, or the ones from the main, like, the most famous thinkers, is that it's very, like, individual. Like, it kind of conceptualizes the self as this, like, isolated thing that just has this free will to choose whatever it wants at any moment. Mm-hmm. But recently I've been very interested in, like, questions about why we prioritize, like, the moment of choice in ethics. Like, why do we think someone is good or bad based on, like, their freedom to, like, choose something in a scenario? Like, are you, like, why not think about all of the factors that led them to be the person they are? Because I think real moral decision making in the real world, you're not acting from, like, a blank slate, right? You're thinking, like, you're kind of acting on intuition or, intuition or instinct based on past experiences and how you've been raised and things like that. And so all of that is to say, that I guess by taking a more, like, zoomed out picture about, like, society in general, I think I've started to think about the self and purpose of existence outside of just, like, in myself as an individual, and more so, like, oh, my existence will have purpose if I am benefiting others, if my existence in relation to other people is meaningful. And yeah, that inspires me to go into law, because I know a lot of people, and rightfully so, think that law is very corrupt and doesn't actually do a lot of good, or is not the most like practical means to do good. But I am too idealistic, but and I think that, or I hope that through law I can somehow affect other lives in a good way. And I think that conceiving of this self and thinking about purpose outside of your isolated self is actually a pretty good way to combat like fear about death. Because then when you think about, at least for me, now when I think about myself going bye-bye one day, unaliving myself, maybe.
Yeah, unaliving. Well, yeah, hopefully going not unaliving yourself.
That's... Just becoming unalive. Yeah. it doesn't feel like the worst thing in the world anymore, because what's important and what's meaningful is not just me as like a one being.
So you've come to terms with your mortality is what you're announcing publicly.
Yes, everyone. I am okay with dying right now. I definitely think I've improved from my 6-year-old self who was like, "Mommy, like I'm gonna die soon." I think I'm pretty good with dealing with death right now, but who knows? That probably will change like 10 years from now when I'm sitting in my law office like, God, I'm like doing nothing. But yeah.
That's fair. Going back with law school, because it gave me a bit of an existential crisis, because I wanted to go into law school. And then I was in a psychology class, and then it was basically, looking back on it, it was almost like psychology propaganda, because it was like, they did a study with like law students, and they found that there's like intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. So this kind of goes back to kind of trying to quantify that idea of authenticity. So intrinsic motivations are very like they respect like autonomy, agency, like people feel like what they're doing is like what they want to do at the end of the day, and it gives them joy, it gives them meaning in their lives, they feel like they're doing something. Extrinsic is usually like validation from like external sources and stuff like that. Like what are their parents' expectations? What are their, you know, partner's expectations? And like, so they could, like people entering into law school, they like would measure like the extent to which they were like extrinsic, intrinsic in terms of this specific goal. And like the ones, I mean, there was a lot of usually people going in interested in corporate law and stuff like that were extrinsic, and intrinsic was like more like human rights based, like law. But they found a really kind of, I feel like, disturbing trend, because I myself and other friends that I had, they were like kind of idealistic, and they were like, oh, well, we're not going to be like those lawyers. But the problem is like there was this bad feedback loop where the most idealistic lawyers, because intrinsic motivation is so much more helpful than extrinsic, like because it's coming from like inside. Yeah. So they became the most driven, and they were the most successful students, and then they would enter into law schools. And the professors would notice that they're getting like really good grades, they're self-driven, self-motivated, and they would start talking to them, and then they would get them into like internship positions and stuff like that, and they would quickly rise like the hierarchy of law school to the corporate jobs. And what you would see throughout is that there would be a value shift where they would start like kind of like not all of them, but in general there was a trend of external extrinsic rewards. And I mean, that just like scared me. And then I was like, yeah, maybe I'm not good enough of a person to deal with that. And I think it also speaks to maybe what you were talking about, that existentialism doesn't quite talk about the social or institutional like specifics that can kind of make people change in terms of like authenticity. Yeah. Because I think this is a case of where it's larger than the individual. The individual is actually the ones that are fully living their existential selves, like authentically, are being rewarded to further and further betray themselves, almost like unknowingly. And I just thought back to that. Like, I was like, that's kind of disturbing, kind of interesting. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I heard from someone else that a lot of people who go into Ivy League schools for law school, even if they want to do something like, I don't know, human rights, poverty law, whatever it is, because the tuition is so fucking expensive, they have no choice but to go into corporate law after they graduate. And it just kind of sucks that even people who are trying to, like, you know, do good and direct their freedom, their existential freedom in that, like, manner, are being barred from doing so. And I think, you know, there are some thinkers who will say, like, who have an extremely radical view of freedom and say, I mean, I guess we would think of them as conservatives now and just say, like, well, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, right?
Radical.
You know? but I don't think you can really fault people for falling into these, like, inauthentic selves of, because what other choice did they have? And I think that's why it's really important to, like, practice non-ideal theories about, like, morality and ethics, and realize that sometimes we have to make decisions where there are non-ideal circumstances, and how do we navigate that?
Yeah, it's making me think of the fact that, like, a lot of, like, especially self-improvement, productivity, I mean, to evoke his name, like, in every podcast, but Jordan Peterson's kind of use of existentialism. Like, it is kind of that, it very much kind of disregards, like, the institutional and social issues that people might face in terms of trying to live their authentic lives. And in a way, he's offering a message that's very, like, yeah, be authentic, be yourself, which is, like, very nice, like, like, clean your room.
Yeah.
But it's, like, you're putting so much of the burden on the individual, and it's, like, I don't know, like, maybe their room isn't clean because of, like, their own issues. Maybe it's, like, unclean because they have to work, like, two or three jobs to pay off their student debt. Yeah. And, like, maybe the issue is actually there's, you know, they literally just don't have time, and they're, like, their personal hygiene and stuff is slipping away. Whether they clean their room or not, it's, like, they have, like, you know, they can sleep for 4 hours and they're, like, you know, it's a mess. And maybe it is actually more of a social or institutional solution where they need to talk with other workers in their organization or something, just as an example. But, like, it's not always just, like, the burden of the individual to, like, make this, like, heroic, defiant, atomized, like, push to be themselves and, like, be the best person that they can be. There's, like, institutional barriers that probably involve some sort of, like, a collective action or something.
And I think especially the problem with pushing this kind of, like, atomized idea of existentialism and, like, freedom and whatnot is that it leads to this hierarchy in people's minds about who's valuable and who's not, right? Because some people are just going to have an easier time exercising, like, their freedom to do what these self-help gurus tell them to do, because they have, like, the resources or the upbringing to do that, versus some people might have a harder time doing that. And also just the factor of luck. Sometimes people are going to get more lucky than others as well in reaching the self-help guru goals. But then if you think that all there is to being someone that has meaning in our society is to exercise your freedom in the right way, then when you look at other people who aren't doing it the right way, as some people say, you end up thinking in this hierarchy, like, oh, these people are high value men, and these people are and these people are low value.
Yeah, and it's kind of quantifying it, and then also it's, like, kind of ironically creating kind of, like, a very inauthentic kind of system, because the advice then becomes very kind of generic, and you just have, like, a bunch of, you know, especially in, like, a kind of men's spaces, just, like, men dressing the same, talking the same, having the exact same views. Like, you can end up with this weird, and I feel like it's very common since the pandemic, is this, like almost cult-like groups where their main, like, ethos is specifically, like, hyper-individualism. And it's, like, but they're all doing the same thing, but it's, like, they just see any sort of, like, any sort of idea of, like, organizing or any sort of criticism against their beliefs as, like, against their own individual liberties. And then that is, like, that just kind of instills their identity even more, and they, like, react to basically anything that, like, is against them just instinctively. And you do, like, I do see that with, like, the I guess, like, the manosphere and stuff like that. Like, just extremely like reactionary, and yeah. it started out as being kind of an appeal to authenticity and nonconformity, which I think is healthy, mm-hmm. but then it almost kind of becomes conformist and yeah. inauthentic.
Yeah, I mean, they're not even doing like existentialism. Yeah, we're giving them like a lot,
lot more credit, than,
right? Yeah. If they're like, "Hey, here's this category you can reach and define yourself by," like that's not even. It's not even existentialism at that point, but mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah. I guess, yeah, to go back to law school, I'm kind of curious what's like, I was going to just ask you, what's your morality? I'll try to reframe
72%.
That. 72%. Yeah. How moral are you? Like, I guess, how is it kind of learning about law and like legal institutions and like the idea of justice? Well, I guess you would still be retaining some level of like skepticism or cynicism regarding like the idea of like absolute values or like pure morality or something like that.
Right. I mean, I think in terms of law, that's why I wanted to do like a master's and then also do law. I want both like the theory and the practical aspects. Mm-hmm. Because again, like I mentioned earlier, we live in a non-ideal world. We can't act as if there are ideal situations. But eventually, at some point, I think there's an important question, especially within academic spheres, which, like, I don't know how it is in psychology, but in philosophy, it's like, oh, like, constant arguing and arguing.
Academia
in general. You could just never stop arguing.
Yeah.
And it's like, when do you choose to just, like, land on a theory or a rule or like some sort of policy and just go with it, because mm-hmm. at some point you're gonna have to put things into practice. And I think that's a really difficult question, because you could keep criticizing if you wanted to,
yeah.
right? And so I think for law, it's kind of like I'm trying to focus on just like listening to people. And I mean, in my latest video, I kind of talk about like the difference between viewing morality via like a system of general principles versus being more like context sensitive, treating every case as a particular situation. And I think in law, I would love to try to move to that, like listening to people who come to me, really listening to what their particular circumstance is. And like, honestly, the legal system has a lot of really shitty components. Like, there's a lot of things wrong with it. And I recognize that it's too big of a goal for me as, like, one person to, like, change it all. But if I could, I don't know, like, change some sort of procedures within it, that would be really helpful. That'd be really great and helpful to other people. We'll see how successful I am at that in, like, 20 years. But 20, yeah.
Well, yeah, I'll put a reminder in.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's not like, I'm not trying to say, like, the absolute values in the law are the best ways to apply to mm-hmm. ethical situations at all. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but you would still maintain that there should be some, yeah, actually to back up a little bit, because I'm kind of curious, because I have another friend in law school,
mm-hmm.
and I've kind of asked him about this. I was like, what do you think of free will? Because I feel like that's something that does come up, like regarding like the justice system making decisions in terms of like looking at somebody's background, looking at the situation, what happened, like the extent to which they're like truly responsible for the action.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious, like what do you think of free will? Because that's another thing with like existentialism where
right.
it would just immediately kind of negate a lot of their arguments as if we aren't like free at all. Like this is all just completely like predetermined and fatalistic and mm-hmm. yeah.
Well, at one point, maybe like a few months ago, I would have said, yeah, I think people still do have free will. Again, I really liked existentialism, and I think regardless of whether we really, really do have free will, it's helpful, practically useful at the end of the day to think we do have it. But again, like I mentioned earlier, being more aware of how like particular situations can shape people,
mm-hmm.
And how moral decision making isn't really just like a blank free will, like choosing
mm-hmm.
from like a state of complete freedom. It's more so like acting on like intuition based on everything that's happened before. I don't really know anymore. Like, I don't really know how culpable you can hold people. I think what would help is trying to get rid of the binary, at least in law, of seeing someone as either guilty or innocent. I think that's really not helpful. Because a lot of the time then it leads to like this adversarial like relationship where you are trying to like punish someone or like let them go free. And I think that it's important instead to recognize that you can definitely hold people accountable. And you can absolutely be like angry and upset by what they've done, but you can also simultaneously like have some sort of empathy for them just as like another human who's gone through stuff, and who has reasons for what they did. I don't think it's helpful or true to hold these things in like opposition.
Do you think it would be like more useful instead of like a guilty, not guilty is like high risk, low risk individuals? Like, we're, so it's like framed less of like, in terms of like moral weight in what they did, and it's more in terms of like how could they potentially affect the rest of society with the background and stuff like that. And that, I mean, that argument could go into kind of like talking about like Minority Report, where it's like now you're just predicting people that are high risk, but more so like people that have committed crimes and then investigating why that happened and then kind of determining like, kind of, okay, is this like a like high risk or low risk? I don't know if that already exists maybe in law, or if that's a
I mean, there are definitely, I guess there are degrees to sentences, which kind of accounts for like if you committed like 7 murders and you're like a psychopath, maybe you have maybe a life sentence, you know? So I feel like the sentence maybe speaks for how high risk or low risk the like judge or jury thinks someone is, but in terms of like the actual sentencing, I don't know. I feel like my gut reaction to that was a little wary. I mean, like you said, the thing about Minority Report, and also just, I'm worried that by labeling people as like high risk or low risk, it still doesn't like address why people get into these situations, or how we come up with our understandings of what is risky or not risky. I think a lot of people are like taught to think that others pose some sort of danger, especially if they fit into certain stereotypes of criminality. And yeah, I just I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I'm trying to think if there would be like a better way of like phrasing that, or a better better terminology. I'm just like, because like my therapist brought up this like talking about like relationships and stuff like that, where it was like I can usually extend a lot of understanding to somebody, and then she kind of brought up like, well, yeah, there's like it's almost the same thing as in a court, where there's like first degree and second degree, where somebody does something deliberate, like intentional,
right?
Like the same thing, like in court cases, if somebody has like some sort of like antisocial personality disorder, it's like they're going to do this like 100% of the time. Like they're just,
right,
you know, but that's a very small amount of the population. Most damage is usually caused by like second degree things, where it's like not like specifically malintent, but it's more like kind of recklessness, or like just not really like well thought out, or somebody was like angry, or just like something like that. Like both in terms of relationships and like criminal things, and sometimes at the same time.
Yeah.
But if it gets really bad.
Charging your spouse.
Yeah. But like, I was like, oh, that's kind of useful, at least for me, in terms of like, I was like, okay, well, I could just like look at it as just like, this person didn't mean what they did, but it's more just like, I need to assess like my own kind of comfort level being around that person, knowing that this is like what they had done before.
Yeah.
Out of that. But you know, there's one thing about kind of distancing yourself, like person to person. There's another thing about determining whether this person should be like locked up for the rest of society should distance themselves from that person. That's why I'm not in law school, because that's too difficult to me.
What's your solution? Lock everyone up who fits into your first degree, but like have a nice like circle discussion with the second degree.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah, treat the second degree super nicely, and like, no, yeah, because even like the first degree, like locking everyone up first degree would be very kind of denying their Because there's also the argument to be made with, like, especially when they do research on psychopaths.
Right.
A lot of the research is technically skewed to, like, psychopaths that are not great at being psychopaths because they've done something and they were kind of sloppy at it. And then they were, you know, caught. So, and you can't really research people that aren't caught because a lot of people aren't going to, like, a lot of psychopaths aren't going to willingly sign up for a study on
themselves.
They're
not going to tell you, like, hey, I'm a psychopath.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that in itself is quite difficult. I guess it's just more in terms of personal dealings. But yeah, when it comes to, like, the legal system, there's just something inherently messy about institutionalizing, you know, human behavior and trying to justice or trying to navigate human risk and accountability and responsibility, because it's like, I do think at the end of the day, our psychology doesn't really allow us for seeing the world in terms of, like, people not causing and impacting things. Like, right. Like we do need to assign some sort of responsibility to other people.
Yeah, for sure.
Even if those people literally, like, they had no, like, we somehow find out, like, in some metaphysical, like, there's some metaphysical evidence that we literally just have no free will at all. Mm-hmm. And these people were just destined to do this thing. We still just can't, like, I don't know. Like, it's very hard to operate without that. Like, it's almost like, it's a bit of a dead end for me, where it's, like, fun to philosophize over, but I'm like, we kind of just have to run with some idea of, like, at least, like, a little bit of free will.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think for sure, like, even if, like, there's, outside of, like, the metaphysical question of whether free will exists or not, like, I don't think we should forget about just, like, the actual, like, phenomenological personal experience people have when they are hurt. Mm-hmm. You know, like, if someone had a gun to my head and I, like, ran you over with my car. Like,
okay.
I don't know, it's a really random scenario that popped into my head.
Was this, like, what your 6-year-old brain was, like, thinking?
Yeah, I was like, yeah, I really want to run over Sisyphus 55 in the future. if I did that to you, I think you would be very justified in still asking me to, like, I don't know, pay for your hospital bills. Ooh, or, like,
thank you. Like, that's very empathetic.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah. Like, you know, pay some sort of damages to you. Even if, like,
yeah, even if somebody,
you
was
know,
going to,
I was being coerced to do it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, a second thing I just was curious about, since you were asking about law, I was wondering, because you were bringing some stuff about the fallacies and, like, studies, or, like, the difficulties of studies, mm-hmm, with psychopaths. How would, like, studies try to quantify or operationalize things like authenticity, or, like, how free you were in some sort of situation?
Yeah.
Like, is that possible?
I mean, you can make the argument that all of psychology is completely, like, BS and none of this is quantifiable. So, and I mean, the research that I did was primarily kind of, like, trying to extract, like, these kind of, like, humanistic psychology, existentialism, stuff like that, and then trying to, like, measure it. So, like, really quickly, we operated under, like, self-determination theory, which basically proposes there's, like, three basic psychological needs. There's autonomy, competence, relatedness.
Okay.
Autonomy is the one that is going to measure authenticity. And it's literally defined as you have a sense of volition in your life. So you, basically, you agree with the actions that you are undertaking. So it kind of, it presupposes that there's some level of, like, reflection going on with your behavior and your actions. And, I mean, it's going to, it pretty much mostly involves a lot of, like, self-report questionnaires. But the thing is, like, that in tandem with looking at these self-report questionnaires where people are scoring high in terms of, like, autonomy, and then seeing that they're happy and seeing that they have, like, high, like, basically other life questionnaires or self-report questionnaires. And then also looking at kind of more physiological measures, like low stress, so, like, cortisol measures, just looking at their general health, you know, do they have kind of, like, high, low rates of depression? Autonomy is, like, an extremely strong measure and, like, indicator of, like it's important to have in your life. Mm. And it kind of goes back to what we were talking about, where it's like whether there's any sort of metaphysical authenticity. When people have the subjective experience of being themselves, they're just, like, happier and their life is great in general.
Right.
So, and yeah, you can make the argument that somebody's, like, you make, like, a really dark argument, somebody in, like, a totalitarian regime, like, you know, Nazi Germany and stuff, where it's like, you know, Eichmann, he seemed like, in some ways, he was, a lot of people misrepresent Hannah Arendt's, like, whole point of that book. He at least from my understanding reading it, was he seemed very agentic and like I was following orders, but I was doing this presupposing that the orders that I was following was because I agree with this overall system. So I was kind of acting out of a sense of agency and autonomy. And so it doesn't necessarily mean that just because somebody's acting authentically, that it means that they're going to be acting morally at the same time. Like, I think that that's like people can jump the shark and be like, oh, they're going to be like these awesome, like, who knows what it means when people are acting autonomously necessarily, mm-hmm. but you know, you could be doing awful things and maybe still experiencing authenticity.
Right.
I know you didn't exactly ask that, but it was just kind of like I started to think about that.
Actually, that's really interesting because at first when you said that, like, oh, you can be authentic without acting morally, I was like, yeah, so true. But then if we separate these two, does that mean that some people, their authentic self is just to be bad?
Yeah, I mean, you would hope not. Like, I would hope not, basically, but you look at certain people, like, that were, like, highly intelligent and also, like, particularly, like, evil. Like, the Night Stalker and, like, well, actually, no, he wasn't that intelligent. Bundy. But, yeah, the Night Stalker is, like, I'm thinking of that. I mean, he was very, I feel like he was definitely acting authentically. He had sort of, like a persona. Hmm. But Ted Bundy was, you know, fairly intelligent, seemed extremely, like, self-aware. And he had also studied psychology. And he seemed like he was just very, like, you know, that was him. Like, there was no sort of, you know, not really, like, remorse expressed or anything. It was almost just like this was a thing that he was going to do, like, no matter what. And he became quite good at doing that specific thing. You would hope that, and I mean, that's actually the importance of the other two basic psychological needs.
Okay.
Because I don't think autonomy alone, like, it's kind of like, it's important, but competence is that you feel some sense of mastery towards your environment. That's super important also, because you need to feel like you're able to do things, like you're able to, like if you want to be agentic, autonomous, like you want to be able to actually fulfill those things. And then relatedness, which is kind of what would squash any sort of like immoral acts, is a sense of belonging and feeling like secure amongst other people and kind of, you know, just sociality. That would make it so, like, if you have all three of those things, according to this theory, you're like having like a great time and stuff, and you're probably not a serial killer. So
yay.
Yeah. So I mean, that's why I kind of like that theory, is because they do kind of incorporate it, where it's like you can't just be like autonomous, but there isn't necessarily like a presupposition also that autonomy would like lead to being like a really great person. Like, you have to, because the other argument is that these are needs. Like, these are like, so relatedness is like a need. Like, you need to have some sort of social interaction. You need to have some sort of like social well-being and some idea of like communion or something. And I mean, yeah, maybe some people with certain disorders and stuff, they don't, or like disorders or, you know, just proclivities, they don't need that. But for the general population, I do think it's true that they usually need to have those three things, and then they'd be like living a sort of authentic good life in a way. Yeah.
Okay. I'm just wondering, like, if it's dangerous in any way to think that for some people their authentic self is just like bad. I'm trying to think, like, because you could conceptualize authenticity as just, and maybe this is actually the three features that we were talking about, like maybe authenticity as just autonomy would say, hey, like, who cares about morality? Mm-hmm. But authenticity as encompassing like the three features you said, because I guess like to be related to other people in a good way, like you'd have to like not be a serial killer.
Yeah.
I
think I'm just like uncomfortable with extending like all three needs to being considered authentic, because I'm like, there would be a bunch of people that are like, I hate people, and they're like, I don't need people and stuff like that. Okay. It's like, you know, I don't want to, it because there, then it starts like kind of supposing like what is the authentic person, instead of, I guess, under psychology, what's like a generally like healthy person according to these studies. Because you at the end of the day, you can't measure authenticity. We would need a study where you're comparing a world where there's like authentic people and then a world where there's inauthentic people, and I don't know what that would
be. Because it's a state of becoming. Because it's not a state static becoming. State exactly. of being.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, maybe I forgot about that. <the day. laughs> Well, this was about an hour, so I don't know if you have any. If you have any other...
I'm gonna start charging for this.
This is this is a really expensive podcast to run. If you have any other kind of topics or questions that you would still like to run through, or if you think we've covered the entire breadth of the existential field.
I think we did a pretty good job of covering every single possible point you could talk about for existentialism.
I'm sure the comments will also agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. No one will say, oh, you missed this. And
no, I've never seen a comment like that.
Me neither.
Okay. All right. Well, you can check out Olivia's channel in the description. And thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks for watching.